Chapter 46. The Change. I have lingered on my childish reminiscences, my bright and happy youth, and now I must tell the rest the blight and the sorrow. It was Christmas, always a joyful and a hospitable time in the country, especially in such an old hall as our home, where quaint customs and frolics were much clung to, as part and parcel of the very dwelling itself. The hall was full of guests, so full, indeed, that there was great difficulty in providing sleeping accommodation for all. Several narrow and dark chambers in the turret's mere pigeonholes, as we irreverently called what had been thought good enough for the stately gentlemen of Elizabeth's reign, were now allotted to bachelor visitors, after having been empty for a century. All the spare rooms in the body and wings of the hall were occupied, of course, and the servants who had been brought down were lodged at the farm, and at the keeper's, so great was the demand for space. At last the unexpected arrival of an elderly relative, who had been asked months before, but scarcely expected, caused great commotion. My aunts went about wringing their hands distractedly. Lady Spelthurst was a personage of some consequence. She was a distant cousin, and had been for years on cool terms with us all, on account of some fancied affront or slight, when as he had paid her last visit, about the time of my christening. She was 70 years old, she was infirm, rich, and testy, moreover, she was my godmother, though I had forgotten the fact. But it seems that, though I had formed no expectations of a legacy in my favor, my aunts had done so for me. And Margaret was especially eloquent on the subject. "Here isn't a room left," she said. "Was ever anything so unfortunate? We cannot put Lady Spelthurst into the turrets, and yet where is she to sleep? And Rosa's godmother too. Poor, dear child, how dreadful! After all these years of estrangement, and with $100,000 in the funds, and no comfortable, warm room at her own unlimited disposal on Christmas, of all times in the year. What was to be done? My aunts could not resign their own chambers to Lady Spelthurst, because they had already given them up to some of the married guests. My father was the most hospitable of men, but he was rheumatic, gouty, and methodical. His sisters-in-law dared not propose to shift his quarters, and, indeed, he would have far sooner dined on prison fare than have been translated to a strange bed. The matter ended in my giving up my room. I had a strange reluctance to making the offer, which surprised myself. Was it a boding of evil to come? I cannot say. We are strangely and wonderfully made. It may have been. At any rate, I do not think it was any selfish unwillingness to make an old and infirm lady comfortable by a trifling sacrifice. I was perfectly healthy and strong. The weather was not cold for the time of the year. It was a dark, moist Yule, not a snowy one, though snow brooded overhead in the darkling clouds. I did make the offer, which became me, I said with a laugh, as the youngest. My sisters laughed too, and made a jest of my evident wish to propitiate my godmother. "He is a fairy godmother, Rosa," said Minnie, "and you know she was affronted at your christening, and went away muttering vengeance. Here she is coming back to see you. I hope she brings golden gifts with her." I thought little of Lady Spelthurst and her possible golden gifts. I cared nothing for the wonderful fortune in the funds that my aunts whispered and nodded about so mysteriously. But since then I have wondered whether, had I then showed myself peevish or obstinate, had I refused to give up my room for the expected kinswoman, it would not have altered the whole of my life. But then Lucy or Minnie would have offered in my stead, and been sacrificed, what do I say? Better that the blow should have fallen as it did than on those dear ones. The chamber to which I removed was a dim little triangular room in the western wing, and was only to be reached by traversing the picture gallery, or by mounting a little flight of stone stairs which led directly upward from the low-browed arch of a door that opened into the garden. There was one more room on the same landing place, and this was a mere receptacle for broken furniture, shattered toys, and all the lumber that will accumulate in a country house. The room I was to inhabit for a few nights was a tapestry-hung apartment, with faded green curtains of some costly stuff, contrasting oddly with a new carpet, and the bright fresh hangings of the bed, which had been hurriedly erected. The furniture was half old, half new, and on the dressing table stood a very quaint oval mirror, in a frame of black wood and polished ebony, I think. I can remember the very pattern of the carpet, the number of chairs, the situation of the bed, the figures on the tapestry. Nay, I can recollect, not only the color of the dress I wore on that fated evening, but the arrangement of every scrap of lace and ribbon, of every flower, every jewel, with a memory but too perfect. Scarcely had my maid finished spreading out my various articles of attire for the evening when there was to be a great dinner party, when the rumble of a carriage announced that Lady Spelthurst had arrived. The short winter's day drew to a close, and a large number of guests were gathered together in the ample drawing room, around the blaze of the wood fire, after dinner. My father, I recollect, was not with us at first. There were some squires of the old hard-riding, hard-drinking stamp still lingering over their port in the dining room, and the host, of course, could not leave them. But the ladies and all the younger gentlemen, both those who slept under our roof, and those who would have a dozen miles of fog and mire to encounter on their road home, were all together. Need I say that Reginald was there? He sat near me, my accepted lover, my plighted future husband. We were to be married in the spring. My sisters were not far off. They, too, had found eyes that sparkled and softened in meeting theirs, had found hearts that beat responsive to their own. And, in their cases, no root frost nipped the blossom ere it became the fruit. There was no canker in their flowerets of young hope, no cloud in their sky. Innocent and loving, they were beloved by men worthy of their esteem. The room, a large and lofty one, with an arched roof, had somewhat of a somber character, from being wainscoted and sailed with polished black oak of a great age. There were mirrors, and there were pictures on the walls, and handsome furniture, and marble chimney pieces, and a gay tourney carpet, but these merely appeared as bright spots on the dark background of the Elizabethan woodwork. Many lights were burning, but the blackness of the walls and roof seemed absolutely to swallow up their rays, like the mouth of a cavern. 100 candles could not have given that apartment the cheerful lightness of a modern drawing room. But the gloomy richness of the panels matched well with the ruddy gleam from the enormous wood fire, in which, crackling and glowing, now lay the mighty Yule log. Quite a blood-red luster poured forth from the fire, and quivered on the walls and the groined roof. We had gathered round the vast antique hearth in a wide circle. The quivering light of the fire and candles fell upon us all, but not equally, for some were in shadow. I remember still how tall and manly and handsome Reginald looked that night, taller by the head than any there, and full of high spirits and gaiety. I, too, was in the highest spirits. Never had my bosom felt lighter, and I believe it was my mirth that gradually gained the rest, for I recollect what a blithe, joyous company we seemed. All save one. Lady Spelthurst, dressed in gray silk and wearing a quaint headdress, sat in her armchair, facing the fire, very silent, with her hands and her sharp chin propped on a sort of ivory-handled crutch that she walked with, for she was lame, peering at me with half-shut eyes. She was a little, spare old woman, with very keen, delicate features of the French type. Her gray silk dress, her spotless lace, old-fashioned jewels, and prim neatness of array were well suited to the intelligence of her face, with its thin lips and eyes of a piercing black, undimmed by age. Those eyes made me uncomfortable, in spite of my gaiety, as they followed my every movement with curious scrutiny. Still, I was very merry and gay. My sisters even wondered at my ever-ready mirth, which was almost wild in its excess. I have heard, since then, of the Scottish belief that those doomed to some great calamity become fey, and are never so disposed for merriment and laughter as just before the blow falls. If ever mortal was fey, then I was so on that evening. Still, though I strove to shake it off, The pertinacious observation of old Lady Spelthurst's eyes did make an impression on me of a vaguely disagreeable nature. Others, too, noticed her scrutiny of me, but set it down as a mere eccentricity of a person always reputed whimsical, to say the least of it. However, this disagreeable sensation lasted but a few moments. After a short pause, my aunt took her part in the conversation, and we found ourselves listening to a weird legend, which the old lady told exceedingly well. One tale led to another. Everyone was called on in turn to contribute to the public entertainment, and story after story, always relating to demonology and witchcraft, succeeded. It was Christmas, the season for such tales, and the old room, with its dusky walls and pictures, and vaulted roof, drinking up the light so greedily, seemed just fitted to give effect to such legendary lore. The huge logs crackled and burned with glowing warmth. The blood-red glare of the Yule log flashed on the faces of the listeners and narrator, on the portraits, and the holly wreathed about their frames, and the upright old dame, in her antiquated dress and trinkets, like one of the originals of the pictures, stepped from the canvas to join our circle. It threw a shimmering luster of an ominously ruddy hue upon the oaken panels. No wonder that the ghost and goblin stories had a new zest. No wonder that the blood of the more timid grew chill and curdled, that their flesh crept, that their hearts beat irregularly, and the girls peeped fearfully over their shoulders, and huddled close together like frightened sheep, and half fancied they beheld some impish and malignant face gibbering at them from the darkling corners of the old room. By degrees my high spirits died out, and I felt the childish tremors, long latent, long forgotten, coming over me. I followed each story with painful interest. I did not ask myself if I believed the dismal tales. I listened, and fear grew upon me, the blind, irrational fear of our nursery days. I am sure most of the other ladies present, young or middle-aged, were affected by the circumstances under which these traditions were heard, no less than by the wild and fantastic character of them. But with them the impression would die out next morning, when the bright sun should shine on the frosted boughs, and the rime on the grass, and the scarlet berries and green spikelets of the holly, and with me, but, ah! What was to happen ere another day dawn? Before we had made an end of this talk, my father and the other squires came in, and we ceased our ghost stories, ashamed to speak of such matters before these newcomers, hard-headed, unimaginative men, who had no sympathy with idle legends. There was now a stir and bustle. Servants were handing round tea and coffee, and other refreshments. Then there was a little music and singing. I sang a duet with Reginald, who had a fine voice and good musical skill. I remember that my singing was much praised, and indeed I was surprised at the power and pathos of my own voice, doubtless due to my excited nerves and mind. Then I heard someone say to another that I was by far the cleverest of the squire's daughters, as well as the prettiest. It did not make me vain. I had no rivalry with Lucy and Minnie. But Reginald whispered some soft fond words in my ear a little before he mounted his horse to set off homeward, which did make me happy and proud. And to think that the next time we met, but I forgave him long ago. Poor Reginald! And now shawls and cloaks were in request, and carriages rolled up to the porch, and the guests gradually departed. At last no one was left but those visitors staying in the house. Then my father, who had been called out to speak with the bailiff of the estate, came back with a look of annoyance on his face. "A strange story I have just been told," said he. "Here has been my bailiff to inform me of the loss of four of the choicest ewes out of that little flock of South Downs I set such store by, and which arrived in the north but 2 months since. And the poor creatures have been destroyed in so strange a manner, for their carcasses are horribly mangled." Most of us uttered some expression of pity or surprise, and some suggested that a vicious dog was probably the culprit. "It would seem so," said my father. "It certainly seems the work of a dog, And yet all the men agree that no dog of such habits exists near us, where, indeed, dogs are scarce, excepting the shepherd's collies and the sporting dogs secured in yards. Yet the sheep are gnawed and bitten, for they show the marks of teeth. Something has done this, and has torn their bodies wolfishly. But apparently it has been only to suck the blood, for little or no flesh is gone. How strange! Cried several voices. Then some of the gentlemen remembered to have heard of cases when dogs addicted to sheep killing had destroyed whole flocks, as if in sheer wantonness, scarcely deigning to taste a morsel of each slain weaver. My father shook his head. Have heard of such cases too, he said. But in this instance I am tempted to think the malice of some unknown enemy has been at work. The teeth of a dog have been busy, no doubt, but the poor sheep have been mutilated in a fantastic manner, as strange as horrible. Their hearts, in especial, have been torn out, and left at some paces off, half gnawed. Also, the men persist that they found the print of a naked human foot in the soft mud of the ditch, and near at this. And he held up what seemed a broken link of a rusted iron chain. Many were the ejaculations of wonder and alarm, and many and shrewd the conjectures, but none seemed exactly to suit the bearings of the case. And when my father went on to say that two lambs of the same valuable breed had perished in the same singular manner 3 days previously, and that they also were found mangled and gore-stained, the amazement reached a higher pitch. Old Lady Spelthurst listened with calm, intelligent attention, but joined in none of our exclamations. At length she said to my father, "Try and recollect, have you no enemy among your neighbors?" My father started, and knit his brows. "Not one that I know of," he replied. And indeed he was a popular man and a kind landlord. "He more lucky you," said the old dame, with one of her grim smiles. It was now late, and we retired to rest before long. One by one the guests dropped off. I was the member of the family selected to escort old Lady Spelthurst to her room, the room I had vacated in her favor. I did not much like the office. I felt a remarkable repugnance to my godmother, but my worthy aunts insisted so much that I should ingratiate myself with one who had so much to leave that I could not but comply. The visitor hobbled up the broad oaken stairs actively enough, propped on my arm and her ivory crutch. The room never had looked more genial and pretty, with its brisk fire, modern furniture, and the gay French paper on the walls. "Nice room, my dear, and I ought to be much obliged to you for it, since my maid tells me it is yours," said her ladyship. "But I am pretty sure you repent your generosity to me, after all those ghost stories, and tremble to think of a strange bed and chamber, eh?" I made some commonplace reply. The old lady arched her eyebrows. "Here have they put you, child?" she asked. "In some cock loft of the turrets, eh, or in a lumber room, a regular ghost trap? I can hear your heart beating with fear this moment. You are not fit to be alone." I tried to call up my pride, and laugh off the accusation against my courage, all the more, perhaps, because I felt its truth. "Oh, you want anything more that I can get you, Lady Spelthurst?" I asked, trying to feign a yawn of sleepiness. The old dame's keen eyes were upon me. "Rather like you, my dear," she said, "and I liked your mama well enough before she treated me so shamefully about the christening dinner. Now, I know you are frightened and fearful, and if an owl should but flap your window tonight, it might drive you into fits. There is a nice little sofa bed in this dressing closet. Call your maid to arrange it for you, and you can sleep there snugly, under the old witch's protection, and then no goblin dare harm you, and nobody will be a bit the wiser, or quiz you for being afraid." How little I knew what hung in the balance of my refusal, or acceptance of that trivial proffer. Had the veil of the future been lifted for one instant, but that veil is impenetrable to our gaze. I left her door. As I crossed the landing, a bright gleam came from another room, whose door was left ajar. The light fell like a bar of golden sheen across my path. As I approached, the door opened and my sister Lucy, who had been watching for me, came out. She was already in a white cashmere wrapper, over which her loosened hair hung darkly and heavily, like tangles of silk. "Rosa, love," she whispered, "Minnie and I can't bear the idea of your sleeping out there, all alone, in that solitary room, the very room two nurse shared used to talk about. So, as you know, Minnie has given up her room, and come to sleep in mine. Still, we should so wish you to stop with us tonight at any rate, and I could make Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.